Most owners lose money long before the first tenant ever moves in. Not from bad rent growth or rising interest rates, but from design mistakes and digital infrastructure decisions that they never knew they were making. In today's episode, we reveal the hidden NOI that's baked into your building on day one and how tiny choices can change your trajectory for years. Welcome back to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Bopp. And in efforts to help you build and maintain cash flowing assets, we're uncovering where hidden NOI actually comes from in your portfolio, the decisions that happen before lease up ever even starts. To walk us through it, I'm joined by two experts in these two different but connected lanes, Marcy Sagel of MSA Interiors and Bill Douglas of OpticWise. In this episode, you're going to hear how smart design prevents rework, speeds lease up, and reduces long-term turnover. How owner-controlled digital infrastructure uncovers new revenue and cuts operational expenses that operators overlook. And why so many buildings are accidentally antiquated on the day that they open, simply because the wrong people made poor decisions early on in the design process. If you own, operate, or invest in commercial real estate, this episode is going to change how you think about amenities, infrastructure, and the hidden value trapped in your building. So Marcy, with that, I'd love to get started with you, if you would. For those that aren't familiar with you, please take a moment, tell our audience who you serve and what problems that you solve.
Thank you so much for having me today. We are MSA Interiors, and we are located in Baltimore, Maryland, and we specialize in interior design for multifamily, senior living, affordable housing, student housing. And it's a broad spectrum of what we do, but we focus on what we like to say interior architecture. And so we do all of the drawings for the interior, space planning, furniture fittings, art accessories, and of course, every single finish in the whole building. So that's typically what we do.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. And Bill, how about you guys at OpticWise?
We serve primarily multi-tenant commercial real estate, focused on largely on hospitality, office, and apartments. And the problem we solve is taking their digital infrastructure, which is the networks and the systems in a building. Sometimes it's the edge devices and sensors, you know, most of the time it is, and turn those into data generating, therefore income generating assets, rather than being an expense on the line item. We believe they should be an asset that generates income and has a known ROI driving NOI.
No, fantastic. So that's exciting. So we're gonna try to thread the needle here today. You guys both are, you know, and slightly different backgrounds, but really have one common core and one focus, and that's really helping drive revenues, help drive the bottom line, and increase NOI and the profitability in these various types of properties. And so excited to learn quite a bit more about both of you guys, and and maybe even dive into some case studies of properties where you guys have been successful and really helped increase the profitability for owners. And so, you know, those that are tuning in here today are commercial real estate owners that are, you know, basically across the broad spectrum of, you know, multifamily, office, retail, self-storage, industrial, assisted living, you name it. Those folks are tuning in. And so I think this is going to be a very relevant conversation, and really excited to unpack some of the gold nuggets that we have here today. So with that, I'd say, Marcy, let's start off with you. And maybe the first question I'd pose to you is, what are, you know, speaking about the design side of things, what are some of the design decisions today that actually move the needle on NOI? NOI can be, you know, framed as, you know, lease up speed, turnover reduction. There's a litany of things that go underneath that umbrella, but what are some of the major design decisions that really help move that needle?
The first thing that I like to say is that the design decisions should all be made early and upfront. So when we're making those decisions, you want to make sure they're locked in and the team has made the decisions. We work a lot with the property management group, as well as, you know, who's going to be managing the project, and also with the developer. And we want to lock in what those amenities are early on. Every single property management group has different idea of what they like for amenities, what those sizes of different spaces are going to be, from leasing offices. Are they going to have a touchdown spot? Are they going to have back of house offices? What are they going to have? We want to figure all that up, you know, upfront, making sure that we can kind of, you know, do the space planning early on, so that we don't have to keep redoing it, so that everyone's involved in that planning decision. And so when we're making the decisions, those kinds of things happen early. And then we kind of carve out some of the other things for the return on investment, so to speak. So we want to figure out early on, is it a long-term hold? And if it's a long-term hold, that makes a difference for the kind of decisions that we're making in terms of products, materials, And also just even how we're carving out the space planning. Because as you know, I'll use this for an example, packaging, mail systems, it's changed dramatically over the years. Okay. So now everyone's getting packages, large size packages at home, from bicycles to TVs, delivered right to their apartment. So 10 years ago, we didn't have that amount of packages coming. And in 10 more years from now, it's going to be changed from where it is. So we want to make sure that whatever we're designing, it's going to be adaptable, and that we put it in an area that makes it accessible. So for instance, we want to look at, where are the trucks going to pull in? What's the path from the front door to the package room, to the, you know, to the mail area? What makes it easier for residents to come and get it? So if there's multiple buildings, everyone doesn't really want to come to just one space in the front of the building. So we may have to divide it up, and we look at all of these things, and those help us make some decisions early on. Same goes with amenity areas. They're constantly changing and they're evolving, and we're sort of giving them a facelift every, you know, anywhere from every 5 to 10 years, kind of giving something new and exciting. Let's say for a golf simulator, we might put a golf simulator in. We might have bike vending, you know, machines, where we put different pieces for a bike, tubes, pumps, little pins, whatever it is. We might do cold storage and food delivery. That may change. We may put that in the front, and then it looks sort of junky when you have, you know, multiple family buildings that have, you know, 500 plus units, and people are getting food delivery all day, every day. We want to make sure that we're being thoughtful to think about all of these different places that things are going to land, and how we're going to evolve with those over the course of a long-term hold. So those all are impactful for the return on investment, especially for a longer-term hold.
No, I appreciate that. You make me giggle about the packages. You know, we're all receiving packages, and I tend to trip over a multitude of boxes at our front door every time I come home, so much that our neighbor has coined our home prime time because of all the Amazon trucks that show up. So I'm very familiar with that concept. With that, would love to, you made a comment there. I want to unpack a little bit. You made a comment about whether a particular property is going to be a short-term or a long-term hold, and that really helps drive the decision-making of maybe which path you guys take. So what are some of the considerations there? Maybe some of the differences that might come about if a client of yours says, well, you know, we're going to build it and flip it. You know, we're going to build it, we're going to stabilize it, and then we're going to be out of this project. Whereas it could be a client that is building it to hold long-term for multiple decades. What are some of the changes and considerations that come into play?
So we have a lot of family REITs and investment groups that we work with nationwide. And when they do projects, they are very long-term hold. So they are looking for us to design the building to have a longer, what I call shelf life. So when we're looking at finishes and looking at different kind of amenities, we're putting things that are not kind of too crazy, not the color of the moment, you know, not putting up something that is going to just last a year or two. And we're not making it, you know, like a hotel, like a sort of what I call a funky hotel. We're making it more long-term. We're making it have visuals that can hold a longer shelf life. And that's really the key word, because we have other people that want the latest and greatest. So we have clients that say, no, I want the most innovative, the most new. I want, give me out of a box, new concept of amenities. And we have to do that. But guess what? They may not be used. They may not be as functional. They may not be as thought out. They may be very innovative. But we have projects we've put full basketball courts in, okay? And maybe two people have used the basketball court. So you have to kind of think about, how can those things evolve? What is going to be used? What's not going to be used? And the one area that any person who's ever done a multifamily will tell you, especially after COVID, is that co-working is the number one choice for putting into a multifamily investment building, no matter whether it's short-term or long-term. We put Zoom rooms in, we put podcast stations in, we put individual little areas where people can go on their own, or an area where they might just lounge on a couch behind a closed door for the whole entire day rather than being in their apartment. So there's co-working is probably the number one thing that people want in a building. Second thing that I think that people want long-term or short-term is they want an outside area to go to. Doesn't have to necessarily have a pool. They just want to be able to sit outside and get some air. So we try to activate some of those outdoor courtyards or spaces around the building, in between the building, anywhere we can carve out benches, outdoor seating, or just some, you know, some fun areas for people to kind of take their computer outside and get some fresh air. So again, just giving that sort of like open outdoor airy space.
I love the co-working element. I mean, it's been many, many years since I've been in a new Class A type of facility. I've never been in one that's had co-working, dedicated podcasting rooms, but I think that's absolutely brilliant. It makes sense, especially, the work at home economy that we're in at this point in time. And so that's a ton of sense. So you mentioned co-working and then outdoor space. Those are like the two most desirable amenities. What are some of the amenities that you see that still get implemented or implemented today that really aren't desirable? Like I know that some of this has to be done for marketing purposes. You know, you got to put the fancy gym in, you got to put the fancy clubhouse and the pool and litany of other things I'm probably not thinking of. And a lot of it's just more to, present a pretty website, pretty marketing package, but maybe the majority of the residents will never even step foot in the gym or the recreational facilities that are there or the clubhouse. What are some of those amenities that you find to be more often than not a waste of money? Like there's really no ROI and no need for, a multifamily developer to ever even include them or any other type of developer, for different clients that you work with. What are those amenities that are really just a waste?
We put gaming in a lot of buildings, in just about every building, and gaming is different to every developer. So gaming, traditional gaming for us means a pool table, possibly, a foosball, skee ball, whatever, or an actual gaming room where younger people can get in front of a TV and have a larger format TV that they can actually game with other people in whatever game it is that they're using. So what we find is, while those are popular, they're more popular for a rentable space. Okay. Like the gaming room is very popular if we attach it to a bar area at a serving area that people can actually rent the space out. And we find that's incredibly better for ROI, okay, rather than just giving a plain old game room. So, of course, just about everybody wants some type of game room because people like them. But again, you want rentable space areas. Spaces where people can host showers, engagement parties, functions that can be separated from the rest of the building. So we find those have more value when we have them, closed off and more rentable.
I suppose that if you have a ground up build and you're working with a client from the beginning of the project, right? Like you can design this out. You can make it exactly how they want it. What's going to bring the highest value, the highest ROI, but how about retrofits? Additional challenges associated with taking a vintage product, something that maybe is, 20, 30 years of age and actually breathing some of this new life into it. What are considerations that are taken into place there that, and how do you look at those projects versus that of a new build?
We typically have projects that are being renovated on a yearly basis. So basically, okay, we're either brought in to renovate a project and update something that could be 20 or 30 years old. And we are looking at not only electronics, which is probably the biggest thing that needs to be uplifted after 20 or 30 years, but how are those electronics, and I'm sure Bill will come into this, how do those electronics play into the rest of the amenity spaces? Everything from lighting to speakers to drapery, even electronically moving in our amenity areas. And how are they going to function once we get the change? And basically, what's our budget? Because those items are typically going to be a higher cost level. And so we want to make sure that we're telling developers, and this is something we do on a regular basis, we'll come in and we'll do what we call a budget planning for 5 years. And we'll take that budget over a 5 year to 10 year period and we'll carve it out for each year. So we'll determine that we're going to do a certain amount of renovations the first year, a certain amount of renovations the second year. So we're going to kind of play with all of those as we move through the 5 to 10 year period. And during that time, we will intertwine newer technology, uplift all of that, including possibly going from a key track to a door to a fob to a door, and all of those electronics changing over to newer technology when we're working on an older building. So that's typically how we do it. We kind of phase it in.
No, I appreciate that. And you know, I love case studies. I think that really helps us wrap our arms around and better understand, you know, a real world, real life example of you in action. And so is there maybe a recent project or a project that comes to mind where, you know, you guys getting involved, like kind of, you know, intervening earlier on in the project, directly improved NOI from what would have happened without your intervention? And, you know, if so, you know, what were those measurable results?
When we look at a building, we're looking at a lot of things that are a little bit different than the developer might be looking at. So we're looking at a few things for us that's really important. One, hitting our budget. Two, making sure that there are no changes once construction starts, if that's at all possible, because that's when you get into very large dollar changes, and we don't really want to see that. And if you're doing good documentation from the beginning, you don't have that, as long as there's a lot of, you know, weekly meetings, biweekly meetings, so that we're coordinating with all the teams and making sure that everybody is on the same page, that we know exactly what's happening in a space. So as we move down that path, we want to make sure that we're looking at what our lease up is. How fast is that lease up for our client? Because when we're doing a new build, that's really what's most important. How quickly can we get that building leased? And we look at it and pay attention to it. And not only do we do that, we come back in 3 months, 6 months, a year, and we look at talking to the property manager on site. We talk to the supervisor for maintenance on site. We want to find out, what are you having difficulty with cleaning? What are you having difficulty maintaining? What do you like? What don't you like? We're gaining knowledge from all of that so that we continue to give people a really good product. And to us, that's really where our ROI is, because we're looking at the lease up, the whole, you know, the cleanability, the wearability, and all of those items are really important from a design standpoint to get the best ROI for ourselves.
Okay. No, fantastic. Marcy, great insights. Appreciate you sharing that. And we'll love to maybe switch gears a little bit and kick it over to you, Bill, and let's maybe dive into the digital side of things. And so maybe talk to us a little bit more. You gave us that brief introduction of you know, who you are, who you serve, but where does the digital equation come into play here?
There's a lot of overlap with what Marcy just said. So when you're building out those amenity spaces, think about digital being all the way through to the tenants, not just operational. So imagine an experience where the tenant could go down to that amenity space and still be on their own private network, connected to all of their systems that they have, whether they're in their property or out in the electronic world, and controlling them and control all of their users, but move from their unit to their friend's unit to that amenity space and still be on their own network on a platform that is monetized by the building, not by an ISP. So that generates a lot of revenue at very high margins, but then converging the operating systems, all of the operating systems that Marcy mentioned are part of it. You know, you talk about those systems all have a digital tail. So how are they connected, and where's the data that they're generating going? Are you able to track how those amenity spaces are being used? Do you want to? I'm not saying track people's activity on the internet. I'm just saying track where they are in your property as a body, not as an identifiable person. But do you know if the pool and the gym is being used? It's very straightforward to, you know, space utilization is demonstrably proven to impact NOI. So you have to know if it's being used or not before you can enlist Marcy's help to redesign it, to retrofit it. So if you asked us what we would do with an old apartment complex to renovate, I would say monetize the direct to unit internet. If that means getting rid of your bulk contract that you're getting $4 a month on and trading it for $30 or $40 NOI per month, start there. But build all of the digital infrastructure, meaning the networks in your building, consolidate them and build them on a platform that you, the property owner, own. And then therefore you can reduce your operating expense, you can reduce your CapEx. So Marcy mentioned, and we didn't orchestrate this, but she mentioned switching to fob locks. You know, smart locks are now your phone instead of just a fob, but it takes sensors. It takes a whole nother system. how is the door lock itself going to communicate back to the platform, whichever vendor that the property picks? We're not the vendor that sells smart locks, for instance, but getting from the door lock to the internet or to the on-prem control unit is part of the digital infrastructure flow. So do you have to put in a whole nother network just because you want smart locks, or can you just piggyback on the network that you already own? We believe it should be the latter. You should not have to. You should be able to retrofit any aged apartment building with smart locks and not have to pay for another network, only pay for the devices that you're using on the doors themselves.
I think there's quite a bit to unpack there, probably more than I know to ask of. And so maybe, you know, I'm going to try to have you break this down into layman's terms for me, and then hopefully, you know, everyone else already understands it. But I just so that I fully can comprehend the various value propositions you can bring to the table. And so let's use the example of a multifamily property, maybe an existing, you know, 20-year vintage multifamily property. Maybe break down some of the what are the top, like, you know, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 hidden asset value opportunities that exist in that 20-year-old multifamily property, like. Where can you guys, and you know, each one individually, break down, like, if you were looking at this client brings this property, I've got this 280 space community, please help me uncover some, you know, hidden revenue opportunities that I don't know exist. What are they, or what could they be?
They don't necessarily have to be revenue opportunities to be NOI opportunities. What technology services are your tenants buying, but not from you? Could you provide internet? Could you provide, I mean, right down the line, do a survey of your tenants and see where they're buying it. And you may or may not have a bulk agreement on your property. You may be getting some shared revenue from an ISP. You may not. I'm going to pick on them because that is revenue. That is revenue that we strongly believe that the apartment complex should own. It's your tenant. Why aren't you deriving that revenue? But I believe it goes to the user experience of your tenant in the property. When they sign their lease, their internet should work. And it should work from anywhere without having to buy a device and without having to wait for the cable guy, right? And then if you look at from operating perspective, how many systems do you have and how many networks are there in the property? Do you know where they are? Do you know who owns them? And do you know where the data is going that each of these systems is generating? So that's a very long question. It's a tedious process to do a digital audit. But at least when you do a digital audit, and you can do it yourself, I mean, we'll give you the form. You can just ask your team to fill it out. It's not something we have to sell. I'm not here to sell anything. And you do that, at least you know what you don't know. Where can I consolidate systems? Why do I have 15 systems and 11 networks when I probably only need 2 networks? And fire and safety is always a separate one. Anything IP-based should be on one network, and that network could be hardened. And we believe you should monitor and manage it just like you do all of the other systems in your building. But why is technology treated like an expense? Open that closet and see blinking lights and there's wires everywhere. Nobody wants to go in there. They just close it and say, ah. So why isn't it treated like the asset that it is? It could generate income and you could reduce your utilities by 3 or 5% first pass. You could keep your insurance from going up 10% next year and tap it to a 1%. Just by having the right data and collecting information, maybe it's new sensors, but sensors aren't that much money. So I would say, look at both sides. What could you monetize for revenue and what could you optimize for expenses? And the digital infrastructure is just the core of the networks. And then the third question is, where's the data? Like if you look at your access controls versus your video security versus your, you know, HVAC or building automation, as sophisticated as a 1980s building is, there's probably no building automation system. Maybe it's just a bunch of thermostats for common area. Go to the pool systems. You mentioned a pool. Are you collecting data from that? And if not, why? But if yes, where is it? How come I can't look across those from my data and find other ways to optimize? And people will talk about AI everywhere, but machine learning is a part of AI that's predictive analytics that's been around 15 or 20 years. We now help our commercial real estate clients use predictive analytics or even optimization analytics because they can see the data. So the underlying value of the data from the property that you own is largely being ignored, or the vendor has it and they're not trying to keep it. There's nobody's ever asked them for it. Some vendors are trying to keep it and they want to charge you for it. But that we're seeing go by the wayside. So it was a very long answer to low-hanging fruit would be monetize the internet. You've got parking, put dynamic parking pricing on, We have several clients close to football stadiums, close to concert venues, and their parking is static price-wise. You know, why is it $8 when people are paying $30 to park, for instance? So we see thousands of dollars come out of parking, thousands of dollars come out of reduced like number of times they paid for redundant services on networks they didn't need. Just do a digital audit and you can pull thousands of dollars per month out of the OPEX.
Yeah, well, you're preaching to the choir. We own parking. And so one of the biggest levers that we pull is just that, you know, introducing dynamic pricing, you know, finding parking garages that are just charging a flat fee no matter what time of day, no matter what the, you know, supply demand factors are, and just making slight adjustments there based on, you know, time of day, your rates, what have you.
You got to look at the data. The data could be the venue's public calendar, or the data could be number of cars in line.
So as it relates to internet, that you've hit on that a couple of times, seems like that's a big one. That's kind of like one of the, you know, initial ones that we would take a look at where there could be opportunity. And so assuming that in this vintage 80s building that I presented here, it doesn't have any type of bulk plan, doesn't have any revenue plan, you know, revenue share plan in place. And so what does that look like? What are the opportunities out there? And then how would that look for the building owner as far as kind of really owning and controlling their own digital infrastructure?
Well, even in an 80s building, there is a wired infrastructure going to every unit. So chances are you could leverage that wired infrastructure without having to do a massive retrofit. You would need some switches. Maybe you don't want to do Wi-Fi because it's, you know, I don't know. Is it a garden style or is it stacked? You know, it depends on the layout, whether you do that. But either way, every one of your tenants is paying for internet. So why aren't you selling it to them? Why aren't you selling them better, private, secure internet that's redundant versus letting them have to fight for it and wait for it from a utility and experience with no or little customer support? Like up the experience, market it under your brand and have it supported 24/7 by English speaking customer support agents. Now that's, you could make minimum $25 a month NOI for a wired connection. Minimum. That's bare minimum. That's in a Class B market. We have clients earning $80 or $90 a month NOI in higher end markets with full Wi-Fi and integrated technology services package that they add other things onto, and the tenants gladly pay because it's less expensive, or they're working from home. We talked about working from home. What if you could work through the firewall on site and be connected to your employer's VPN without having to slow down and having the ability to do that from the pool or to do that from the sitting space Marcy mentioned, right? They want to take their computer and go get air. What if they could do that and still be on their employer's network? Imagine how much that lands with a more tech-averse audience willing to pay more. You know, you have a better offering so that you're not just renting space. You're providing an experience for the tenants, the residents. And the same thing goes for office. You know, the same thing goes for the mixed use on the first floor of all these facilities. What if the apartment dweller could go down to the coffee shop and still be on their own network? Or go to the golf simulator and still be on their own private network? I'm in 505. I go to visit Marcy in 101. I'm still on my network, even though I'm standing in her apartment. Well, it's not that difficult. These technologies work in other industries. I, as a leader, this is my seventh company, I tend to take solutions that work in other industries and bring them to lagging ones. And that's what we've done here over the past decade. I've been driving this bus for 10 years at OpticWise, and that's what we continue to do by listening to our customers' problems. We just find the solution. They tell us what they want. And lately, they've been telling us they want business intelligence. They want to know more about what's going to happen. Maybe it's asset management from a CapEx perspective, large equipment. Maybe it's predictive with not necessarily rents. That's pretty much covered by a whole other industry, but predictive when it comes to expenses. Like, what should I expect? If I look back through my 5 years of operating history, I know I'm going to see this many failures of this many things at this time of year. It's very straightforward. It's too much for a human to do, but it's not too much for a machine to do, especially programmed on good data. So think about the value of the data from all your properties.
Is there a particular asset class that you guys have spent you know, more time than others in as of your recent years? You find it, is it mostly multifamily? Is it retail? Is it office? Or is it a, you know, proportionate share of all?
We've seen a lot of change in mixed use because both office and apartments have those on the first floor. Nobody wants to be on the first floor anymore. Offices are going through a whirlwind change. You know, they were 10 cents on a dollar 2 years ago. And now that they're being acquired again, we're seeing a lot of the footprint from tenants. So the same 300,000 foot building, instead of having 15 tenants, now it has 24. The employers, which are the tenants, right, in a commercial office building, have a, you know, a hybrid solution now for their employees. So they don't have to come in all 5 days, but they do have to come in. So their footprint is shrinking. So they're changing massively. So they're being forced to do renovations, and they're all doing technology uplifts. So apartments, I think the biggest change we've seen is how to deal with EVs, you know, electric vehicles, and the smart locks, smart thermostats. Those are the biggest waves. And then that drives the need for digital infrastructure improvements because the network can't handle that traffic. So who's going to buy it? Who owns it? You don't want your vendor to own a network in your building. You think Toyota would ever let you do that in their manufacturing plant?
Good point.
Network in their building and take data out.
Good point.
You think, you mentioned Amazon. You think Amazon would ever let you do that in one of their distribution facilities?
Yeah.
Commercial real estate does it almost every day.
You're right. It's become the norm, right? So like you make a valid point, but we've accepted it to be the norm.
I don't think it's going to remain the norm. And the early adopters are already saying it's not the norm. Like we not only make more money to own it, we control the user experience, which is our tenant, which is where our revenue comes from. So they're treating their tenant better by owning the digital infrastructure and by actually looking at the data. Like Marcy's job would be a lot easier if she knew how our building was actually being used. She could really redesign it better.
Yeah, well, let's talk to that a little bit. So you referenced, you gave an example, a couple minutes back on, the data that you can, folks that are actually using the pool based on the data that you're collecting. Is there any additional way that you leverage that outside of maybe, working in conjunction with a team like Marcy's to help better design or better utilize a building?
The data belongs to the building. So I would have to ask that question to the building owner. The only time we'll say, no, it's impossible, is if they're trying to geofence or trying to figure out what their tenants are actually doing on the internet or on their electronic presence, because we don't track that. We believe in privacy. Okay. So when I'm talking about data, it's generated by the system on the property, not by a person.
Okay.
So yes, we can do anything with a system. And when I say occupancy sensors, that's just counting bodies.
Gotcha.
I don't know what they're doing. I don't know who they are. It just, the pool's got 35 people in it right now. The TV room, there's five gamers in it. And I just track it, period. And then you can go look at it. And then I'll ask Marcy, what would you do with that data then?
So I was going to add that, we work with very large property management groups nationwide. They're some of the largest ones. We work with them over and over and over again on many, many, many jobs. They do have the data. They do understand exactly who's using what amenities. And for instance, pools have to have a gate. They have a fob to get into the gate. They know exactly how many people come in every single day and who those people are if they really want to know. But they take that data, and we do have big discussions about different locations, from urban to suburban to, different levels. We're hitting different market shares. All of those things come into play when we're looking at who's using amenities and what that potential client base might want as amenities. So we have big conversations about those from data, exactly what Bill said, that they have gathered over hundreds of thousands of properties across the nation. And so they take that data and they put it into different categories: pricing of rent, types of properties, urban, suburban, garden style, whatever it is. And they divide it up, and we get that information to utilize on what amenities might be appropriate for that particular build out. And so they supply us with that. And so it's very, very helpful in helping to determine what might be effective, what's most rented, where they can gain revenue, and all of those different things that we talked about earlier in the conversation.
Well, Kevin, that's large, right? Marcy said they were large because they had the data. Most of our clients are middle market. So think 10 to 200 properties in their portfolio. And they don't have it. It's not that they can't get it, but they've always just operated space. Like, we just rent space. I hear that a lot. No, that's all we do. We operate a building. True, but this is a way to operate it better. So just ask, where's the data? If it's not there, there's a way to get it. But if it is there, why don't we have it? It's just a twofold question. Just ask your own manager inside of your portfolio if you don't have that data. because it's so valuable, like Marcy said.
A great transition point to ask maybe a question that's applicable to both of you. I mean, like, you both have shared compelling reasons as to why we should be, you know, as building owners and operators, thinking along these paths of engaging with firms such as yours to drive additional NOI. But, you get folks that get stuck in their ways, right? Like, I think, Bill, to your point, we've in the commercial real estate space, historically, we've taken it as a norm to not own our digital infrastructure, right? Like, we've just outsourced it. You know, again, Toyota, Amazon, they wouldn't do that. Why do we do that? But we've considered it to be the norm. And so we've all just adopted that. And so with that being said, it's we've been operating in the same manner for many, many decades. And a lot of folks don't like change. They like making more money, but they're slow to make shifts. They're slow to make change. And so, what's the biggest resistance, or how do you get over the resistance that you might receive from a developer or property owner when it comes to these different methodologies that you guys share and preach and can show them of how they can drive additional NOI in their properties? And maybe, Bill, if you want to take that first, and then we'll follow up with Marcy.
Well, there's no doubt a very strong, nice way to say it is status quo bias. Like, it works for us. This is what we're going to continue to do. The more we get involved earlier, you said developer or operator, so I assume you're talking about new builds. The earlier we are in the process, the more we can save on CapEx. If you're going to make a digital infrastructure or a design change prior to it going to bid for your subs, the more money you actually recognize as the owner. Change management is a large issue when it comes to digital transformation in any industry, and it's true here. We wrote a whole chapter in the book, the Peak Property Performance book, about it. You just continually tell your team why you're doing it, continually tell them the vision, continually get younger or more tech-forward thinkers on your team, and delegate more. So I'm not the people running the property can still run the property, but they need to have digital insights, data insights. So the earlier you're involved, if you're going to buy a property, do a digital audit, make that part of your diligence, like know what you don't know. If you're going to build it, then set the stage, like who's going to make the decisions on, like we do it on design. The architect does it on the physical design. Who is in charge of everything when it comes to systems in this building? Whether they're operating systems or devices or anything low voltage. We have an electrical engineering firm that designs, maybe even installs. How come we don't have that for our digital infrastructure? Start asking that question earlier. And then you'll see a massive ROI, because instead of building 12 networks, you could build two and save yourselves $1 a foot in a new build. Large numbers. Like that'll move the needle. This is not an expense as much as it is the consolidation that you can turn into a capital item that generates income.
Well, I think that's the shift, right? And that becomes a resistance, is getting folks to think that this is not an expense. This is an opportunity for, significant value creation, right? And I think that's really where the initial resistance comes from, is everyone just kind of outlining it as an expense and not really seeing being clear or fully understanding or comprehending the value proposition that comes from going through, an audit and identifying some of these potential, opportunities that exist. So Marcy, how about you? What are your thoughts?
Like I said earlier, when we get involved early on, which we do because we want that with our clients, the property management group is directing usually what is happening from a technology standpoint. They're making decisions for the client. They've been hired early on to help guide the process. And they're basically signing on to lease the building within a certain period of time if the developer does certain things that they need to be followed, such as technology, path of technology throughout the building, like Bill mentioned. How are they going to make money on some of that technology? And how's that technology going to be intertwined throughout the building? So we're a lot of times dictated from the property management group. And what we've seen over the years is obviously there's some good property management groups, and then there are some that are really antiquated and are stuck in their ways, just like you mentioned, Kevin. And they're usually very small and regional. And what we find is that they think that they know exactly how everything should go, even though they've never done properties outside of their one little region that they've ever worked in. So, we have a dilemma sometimes. We have to go with what they're suggesting. But at the same time, we point out return on investment for the client. We have a conversation with them and say, we don't necessarily always think that that's the right way to go. And not from it being a difficult standpoint, but from a, hey, we have a lot of experience doing this nationwide, and here's what we have found. So here's the good, and here's the bad, and here's somewhere in the middle that you might want to go, just so that you're being covered in the future and you're not being left behind. And so if you're starting with a brand new building and you're already antiquated, which is what we have found with some of these smaller property management groups that don't have that national experience that we're looking at on other properties, you could be designing something that's antiquated right out of the gate. So we like to kind of look at that and make some suggestions. And then ultimately, it's up to the developer if they want to invest in that. And ultimately, if they just want to listen to the property manager. And what we like to tell them is, make sure that you are moving towards the future. You're not just designing for just now. You have to design for what's coming later, because again, you know, you don't want to make these infrastructure changes down the road if you don't have to. You want to do them up front, where you're going to, like Bill said, you're going to intertwine that cost into the value of the building, and overall, in a larger time period, save the client money over time and investment. So that's really what we're looking at.
I'm assuming it's got to be a little easier to state your case directly to a client. So if the existing property, you're not working with you're not being directed by a property management company, you can state, you know, kind of the benefits you can bring to the equation directly to the owner of the multifamily property versus that of the property management company. Is that typically the case, or are you almost entirely working with a property management company and not necessarily the client directly?
The more we deal with the owner, I mean, of course, we love dealing with property managers, but their vision is on that property. The more we talk to the owner, the more they're seeing not just the P&L implications and the balance sheet implications, but the vision for the property. They have the vision. I mean, they could change the property manager. Like Marcy said, it's a brand new building, but it's already antiquated because somebody missed that. Like somebody in the process missed that, or it was a vendor that was favored for multiple reasons. I can go down. That could be a whole nother show. But that is the whole challenge, is what is the best for the owner? And the property manager has that joint interest as well, but sometimes it doesn't fit into their status quo.
You're never going to have an absolute true alignment of interest between an owner of a property and a property management company. You might have it pretty close, but it's never 100%. So,
well, the vertically integrated ones get close, yes. But they also miss, like Marcy said, they miss the nationwide vision of the bigs. You know, they can share data with what works on the West Coast versus the East Coast if you're not on either one. And the vertically integrated ones often miss that. So it's also, you know, the better view on the other side of the street perspective, you know. I'm not advocating one versus the other. I'm saying there's always something better by what you don't have, it seems like.
I definitely agree with that. You know, we have to work, as Bill does, in all different situations, directly with the developer, directly with the property manager, as a team. And so we effectively want to give the developer the most bang for the buck, so to speak. And what we do is, if we don't necessarily agree with the direction that we're given, we may, like I said, put out a whole market of why those cost might be more effective over a longer period of time. And so really kind of giving the developer something to think about, and not just being told, because in 5 years, they may not be with that property management group, because that's definitely a moving target with a lot of developers. They don't necessarily, if they don't have their own property management group, and very few do, they are hiring a group, and they may not like what that group has done, and they may move to a different group. Because again, they want total lease up, and they want, you know, less turns each year. And, you know, those are the way, or maybe they want more turns because they want to raise their value. It just depends. You know, we come in and we shift what the apartment unit looks like to gain more dollars. So it just depends. But it's a moving target, is what I like to say.
Marcy, you mentioned that often the property management groups are in charge of the technology decisions and new developments. And I want to just point out the irony, because the technology investments are longstanding, they're capital related, they drive OPEX, they impact CAPEX, yet the property manager is making them. And the property manager is not a technology firm. The property manager is great at knowing the market rate, great at showing and leasing up the property. That is not a technology firm. I mean, you can't be a jack of all trades. I know some of them try to be, but it's impossible. Like I'll tell you exactly what we don't do, and we're not going to try and do it. We can refer you to all those companies that do that because we specialize in what we do. Can't specialize in everything. So for a property manager to pick some of these technical digital infrastructure, data-driven solutions is a huge ask. And often that's where it leaves a gaping hole when the building gets turned on. So I encourage you to ask strongly, why are you making, if you're deferring to your property manager and you're an owner, whether it's existing or new build, ask why they're making that decision. Ask, do they have a financial incentive to make so? Does their property management firm own some of that vendor? Is there a commission involved in that vendor? Are you going to be around if this vendor doesn't work? Like what support is there if that you're going to provide for making this recommendation? And then people make different decisions.
I couldn't agree more, Bill, because we do not direct any project with any commission or any kind of motivation based on any kind of back dollars.
100%.
And that's a really big factor with a lot of vendors.
And we encourage everybody to ask their vendors that same thing.
Well, I think what happens is a lot of folks just get, you know, they want the easy button, right? And they take the recommendations from the PM company and just assume that it's, you know, that's the best option for them, you know, because it's being suggested by this third party or this management company. They've worked with them, they have good experiences. Little do they know there could be ulterior motives that they're not aware of.
It's the same thing I like to say with, you know, a GC hires a sub, a flooring sub, and everything's been thought out. Everything's been designed. Everything's been approved. The next thing you know, you've got some flooring sub saying, oh, it's tariffs or we're not going to be able to get that product. And we're going to switch it out for this because we're going to save you some money. But they're actually making 20% more on that particular product. And we don't even know what the finish looks like and whether it's going to peel, scratch, whatever it's going to do. And, you know, I always get upset when products are changed out, not because they're getting changed out. If they had a valuable reason for changing out, I'd be fine with it, but because they're not looking at everything working together in the unit, you know, so to speak. Does the cabinet go with the new floor that you just subbed out? Or, you know, how do they all mix together and look when they're finished? So these are some of the things that, you know, we try to bring to the attention of the developer very early on, and we try to hold specs. And it's the same thing when a property management group, and I love property management groups, they're very effective and they do great jobs, but they, like anybody else, may have an ulterior motive as to why they're choosing something. And it's best to dig into it, get multiple bids, and absolutely get information, not just one path. So that's always my sort of word of advice for that.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. No, well said. And you just want to be conscious of your time as well. Appreciate you guys both coming on here today. You guys have been an absolute pleasure to have here, and some insightful knowledge that you shared. And I think the moral of the story that we're gathering here as we kind of wrap this up and summarize this is enlist the expertise of folks like Marcy, folks like Bill, when you're either looking to develop a property or, you know, refit an existing property to uncover those additional value opportunities that might exist. And so, you know, just again, don't take the easy button, as we're talking about here in the last couple of minutes, of just, you know, utilizing relationships, not saying that they're not, you know, great points of contact from a property management company, but do your homework yourself, enlist, you know, some additional third parties that have very specific knowledge and expertise that can, again, help you uncover, just really, so it sounds like some hidden, you know, hidden gold here that properties just don't consider. So with that, Marcy, Bill, really, again, appreciate you having on the show. For those that want to learn a little bit more about Marcy's work at MSA Interiors or Bill's team over at OpticWise, we're going to put all the information for, you know, links to their websites. And Bill, you've also got a podcast as well. We're going to put that all down in the show notes. And with that, guys, that's all we have. So appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Likewise.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah. And guys, if you've enjoyed this episode today here, be sure to leave a review as well and hit the subscribe button, as it really helps us continue to attract great guests like Marcy and Bill. And so with that, that's all we have for today's show. So we will see you guys on the next episode. Take care.